Coming up, 1 year ago, President Obama promised a broader engagement with the Muslim world. How is that going? And the Eye Care Center in India, where poor people can get first-class medical treatment free. Plus, going into the wilderness to experience the presence of God.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Religious reaction has been strong but deeply divided in the wake of this week's deadly Israeli raid on an aid flotilla headed to Gaza. Muslims around the world protested the attack. And here in the U.S., American Muslim groups urged the Obama administration to condemn what they called the massacre. But there were also rallies of support for Israel. Most major U.S. Jewish groups regretted the loss of life, but asserted that Israel had the right to defend itself. Some in the Christian community supported the Israeli actions, but many, including several mainline Protestant leaders, urged Israel to end its blockade of Gaza. Pope Benedict XVI called the events tragic and appealed for a renewed commitment to dialogue and peace. The Pope traveled to Cyprus, where the aid flotillas have been staging for a previously scheduled pilgrimage. Along with preaching a message of peace, Benedict celebrated the ancient Christian community there, which dates back to the time of the Apostle Paul. This week marks the one-year anniversary of President Obama's landmark speech in Cairo, where he promised better relations between the U.S. and the Islamic world.
So long as our relationship is defined by our differences, we will empower those who sow hatred rather than peace, those who promote conflict rather than the cooperation that can help all of our people achieve justice and prosperity. And this cycle of suspicion and discord must end.
In that speech, the president acknowledged the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been a major source of tension in those relations. He pledged a broader engagement with Muslims on that and several other issues. As one follow-up, the president appointed a special envoy to the Organization of the Islamic Conference, or OIC, the umbrella group of 57 countries with significant Muslim populations. That envoy is Rashad Hussein, who joins me now. Mr. Hussein, thank you for being here. What has changed in the years since that Cairo speech?
Well, the Cairo speech really set out the framework as a part of the dialogue that the president started as early as Inauguration Day when he reached out to Muslim communities. On his second day in office, he appointed Senator Mitchell to ensure that we're doing everything we can to bring a resolution to the conflict in the Middle East. And it's something that we have been persistent on, something we'll continue to be persistent on despite recent events. That event, I think you'll see, will just redouble our efforts. Our attempts to secure a peaceful resolution to the Middle East conflict. Of course, the president, early on, one of the first interviews he did was with Al Arabiya. Then he traveled shortly after that to Ankara, where he made clear that the United States is not at war with Islam. And then in Cairo, where he really set forth the broad framework of dealing with Muslim communities in a comprehensive way, and in a manner which addresses not just the political conflicts, one of which you mentioned, but also creates partnerships in a number of areas of mutual interest. And that really stemmed from the president's belief that people all around the world, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim, or they live in a Muslim country or non-Muslim country, all share the same fundamental aspirations, and that is that they want to have access to education, they want to have the ability to pursue economic opportunity, to have health care, to raise their family in a secure way. And so part of the president's message in Cairo was that we need to establish partnerships in a number of areas, including education, entrepreneurship, health, science, and technology, to have dialogue at the interfaith level, and we've continued to do that in a number of ways. And also while reaching out to the domestic Muslim community, the president sent one of his top advisors, Valerie Jarrett, to speak at the Islamic Society of North America, which is the largest gathering of American Muslims. John Brennan spoke at the Islamic Center at NYU, and recently spoke to outreach to Muslim communities as a part of our national security strategy. We had recently an entrepreneurship summit. So this is really an ongoing dialogue, not an ad hoc approach, where we have a concerted effort to engage Muslim communities at all levels.
But what are the, you know, sort of real-world impact of that talk? And people said, well, the rhetoric is great and talking is great, but, you know, what is the real-world change that happens?
Right. Well, to go through the parts of the Cairo speech, of course, in Iraq, we're continuing, and I think we're doing exactly what the president said we would do in terms of transferring power over to Iraq and following the timetable we set out. I think we're doing the same thing in Afghanistan. In the area of education, we've increased educational exchanges tremendously. In the area of entrepreneurship, the president hosted an entrepreneurship summit, and Turkey has offered to host a follow-up summit next year, and we'll see regional entrepreneurship conferences. In the area of health, we have an excellent cooperation with the OIC on eradicating polio. I was just in Nigeria, where the number of new cases in the first quarter of the year was down to 3, which I think has been a tremendous success and was recognized by the people on the ground there. Also, in the area of health, we're expanding into maternal and child health as a part of the Global Health Initiative. We also had great cooperation on H1N1 before Hajj, when there was a threat that it would spread amongst the people that were performing Hajj and then taking it back to their home countries. In the area of science and technology, we've had our science envoys traveling throughout the region, and we've also had a global technology and innovation fund, which potentially will invest $2 billion for those projects, and it's been one of OPIC's most popular offerings. We've had a major international interfaith conference in Jakarta, and so we're really moving forward in all these areas as we address the tough political issues. And our view is that when we look back, we will hopefully see an administration that successfully dealt with those tough political issues, hopefully had a breakthrough in the area of the Middle East as we continue to be persistent on that, but also sowed the seeds for cooperation in a number of areas.
Well, just speaking of that, is there a danger that all of these things that you've been mentioning, all of that work, will, you know, be jettisoned because of the difficulty of this Middle East issue?
No, because I think there's a track by which we recognize the importance of dealing with the political issues, and we'll continue to deal with those. And at the same time, we're also establishing programs that really go towards the daily concerns that people have in the areas of education and health and entrepreneurship and the other areas that I mentioned. Those political issues are tough issues, but as the president has said, and I think that we've reiterated this message recently as well, although there are difficulties with that issue, and it is a major issue of concern for Muslims all around the world, that's something that we recognize. But we'll continue to be persistent on that and hopefully come to a place where we can reach a breakthrough on that as well.
What is the role of the religious community here in achieving that?
Well, the religious communities, whether they be Muslims or people of other faith, you know, have definitely a role to play in with regards to interfaith dialogue, and that's something that's occurred even before this administration. They have a role to play in informing the policies that that the administration has, and the United States has a long history of that, and that is that while we have a separation of church and state, I think that the values that people, fundamental values that people have as a part of their religious beliefs, can inform some of the goals that we're trying to reach policy-wise, and that is, you know, people believe generally that you should have access to health care, that you should have access to education, that people should be treated fairly, and those are the same types of values, whether someone's a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu or Christian, that will continue to influence the way they look at these issues.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
We'll actually continue this conversation with Special Envoy Rashad Hussein on our website at pbs.org. In other news, the Gulf oil spill disaster is prompting new theological reflections about the environment. This week, a leading conservative Southern Baptist chastised evangelical Christians for not giving enough attention to environmental issues. On his blog, Russell Moore, dean of theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, said that shows, quote, an inadequate view of human life and sin. Moore, who's from Biloxi, called the Gulf catastrophe a threat to national security and American culture. Two U.S. Catholic Church leaders are among those appointed to a new Vatican commission that will investigate clergy sex abuse in Ireland. Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston and Archbishop Timothy Dolan of New York will join seven other church officials on a panel charged with helping victims and ensuring that no more abuse occurs. Pope Benedict said this will help the church on its path to renewal. In a strongly worded open letter, Episcopal Presiding Bishop Catherine Jefford Shorey defended her church's decision to move forward in promoting gay and lesbian bishops. Jefford Shorey acknowledged the controversy this has generated across the worldwide Anglican Communion, but she also raised concerns that what she called colonial attitudes from other parts of the world are trying to impose their theological views on the U.S. Last month, the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles consecrated the church's second bishop in a same-sex relationship. In response, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams proposed that the U.S. church play a reduced role in several Anglican Communion bodies. In Afghanistan, the work of two Christian aid groups has been suspended amid accusations of proselytism. Church World Service and Norwegian Church Aid are under investigation by the Afghan government after a report on a local television station suggested that the groups were trying to convert Muslims to Christianity. Proselytism is strictly forbidden in Afghanistan. Both organizations deny that their people had engaged in proselytism. Around the world, 45 million people suffer from blindness that's preventable or reversible. One large eye care clinic in India is successfully treating these problems, helping nearly 2,000 patients a day, often at no cost. The founder of this clinic calls his idea a manifestation of the divine. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports.
Aravind is the world's largest eye care center, a one-stop shop that even makes many of the lenses and instruments used by its surgeons.
Anterior.
It looks like any of India's high-tech centers where rich Indians and medical tourists can get first-world care at third-world prices. The surgical error rate is as low here as any place in America. The big difference at Aravind is that its patients are among the world's poorest people.
Next, a story about a miracle-working eye hospital in India.
20 years ago, I visited Aravind's founder, Dr. Govindappa Venkatswamy. Everybody called him Dr. V. He'd retired from a government hospital in 1976 and set out to tackle needless blindness. Worldwide, 45 million people still suffer from preventable or reversible blindness. 12 million are in India alone, where the extreme sun and a genetic predisposition are blamed. Many people lose their sight and livelihood by their early 50s.
There is nothing which disables a man like cataract and poor eyesight. There is nothing more easier than to mend it. You just do a small operation.
Dr. V began with a simple idea in an 11-bed hospital with four doctors, three from his own family. It would serve patients who could pay, but the profits would provide free care to the many more people who couldn't afford even the bus fare. So Aravind set out to find patients, mainly through screening camps in surrounding rural areas. For those needing surgery, groups like the Lions Club provided buses to the hospital, where they entered a brisk assembly line operating room. Dr. V's business role model was the American chain store.
In America, you have models, whether it is CA stores or McDonald's hamburger, or you are able to open a chain of shops or restaurants or hotels, or and you are able to organize them efficiently.
You spoke to him here. You were sitting here and he was sitting there and talking about McDonald's.
Dr. V died in 2005, but his office is left untouched as a shrine to him. His nephew, ophthalmologist Aravind Srinivasan, manages a system that's grown to five regional hospitals and 25 satellite clinics. This was the first one.
This is a 32-year-old hospital, so we are probably geared to see about 700 patients a day. Today we are seeing about 1,500 to 2,000 patients a day.
Each pays about $1 for a doctor's appointment. That helps fund even more patients who go next door to a free eye hospital. There's not much profit margin, so a heavy volume of paying patients, satisfied patients, is critical. Efficiency is also critical.
We call this a clinic scoring sheet.
Dr. Aravind, who also has an MBA from the University of Michigan, has continuous productivity reports at his fingertips.
And this statistics talks about service time. How many, what percentage of people were seen within 2 hours?
Patients are promised a completed appointment in 2 hours. A brochure details what they can expect.
So registration takes about 5 minutes. Vision test takes about 10 minutes. Refraction check about 10 minutes.
So this is sort of like a patient's bill of rights almost.
Exactly. So they understand what's happening.
Aravind's reputation is drawing patients from farther and farther away.
Whenever you say eye operations, everyone says, go to Madurai.
55-year-old K.G. Anjaneyalu had been in a 3-year depression that started when cataracts began clouding his vision. He became completely blind 3 months ago. Anjaneyalu and his wife Shoba endured a 2-day train journey to get here.
I was a sportsman. I used to swim. After the cataract, I could no longer move around. I got stuck at home and I started eating. Then a leg injury made me even more immobile. I had problems being overweight and I developed high blood pressure.
By 9 o'clock the morning after arriving here, he was being prepared for surgery. Already dozens of patients had gone ahead of him.
So you've been going for 2 hours and you've done 16
patients. Yeah.
Dr. Aravind and surgeons in several other operating theaters, or OTs, were first working the routine, mostly cataract cases.
But the other OTs are not primarily cataract surgeons. They are primarily doing either glaucoma or cornea. And then they also do some cataract to contribute to the main volume. So we are able to identify or those cases which needs a little more extra attention is segregated from the pool.
Anjaneyalu was a high-risk case, given his hypertension and obesity.
You just have a margin of safety of about 5 to 10 minutes to get the surgery done.
About 10 nervous minutes later, Dr. Aravind had removed a particularly tough, leathery cataract.
The cataract was a little obstinate, but otherwise things went on well. So he'll get about 95% vision tomorrow. So when you see him tomorrow, you'll see a different man, but more confident.
By the end of this day, Dr. Aravind and his colleagues did nearly 300 surgeries, about half of them free of charge. Increasingly, however, patients are seen outside the hospital. Telemedicine connects doctors to satellite clinics, and today's eye camps offer much more on-site, from grinding eyeglass lenses to digital scans. Near the camp, a satellite truck beamed high-resolution images to specialists at the hospital. Technology has improved care, and it's also brought down costs, notably for the intraocular lenses which are implanted during cataract surgery. They used to be imported. Aravind began making its own intraocular lenses back in the early 1990s. They used to cost between $50 and $100 each. Today, they are made in this factory for as little as $2 a piece. Aravind lenses are exported to 120 countries. And they own 8% of the global market in intraocular lenses. This factory is an example of how Aravind turned a supply problem into an opportunity. It's not just business acumen that drives the mission, but also a firm spiritual basis. It is inspired by Sri Aurobindo, a mid-20th century spiritual leader who believed that good works and good ideas are a manifestation of the divine.
Now, part of that is to recognize that whatever ideas that you get is not really your ideas. They are the divine ideas. No? So how do you kind of act on it, but then are not taking the egoistic ownership to those ideas? No? Like, I have done it. No? So how do you train yourself to open up?
One way Aravind has opened up or shared its ideas is by training some 250 hospitals in India and 40 other countries to adopt its methods.
In this institute, we train organizations to become more efficient. No, we completely give our intellectual property or our store away. No, there we open up our systems, processes, how much we charge the patients and our records.
It's the ethos set by his uncle. Dr. V, who was single, never took a salary. In fact, he mortgaged his home to start Aravind. And he also coaxed or inspired 34 members of his extended family to work here, starting in 1976 with his sister Nachiar and her husband. Both left surgical careers in America to work here for about $20 a month.
today, oh my God, we are very, very happy. In fact, at that time, in 80s, we were not happy. Even though Dr. V was happy, in a family life, you know, like me and my husband, two children, it was not easy for us. We couldn't even buy a cycle. At that time, we didn't appreciate his far vision.
God bless you, madam.
God bless me, definitely. God bless the surgeon.
She says the satisfaction of seeing patients like Anjaneyalu restored to full lives makes up for any material privation, although over the years, salaries have greatly improved for the 220 doctors and some 2,500 other Aravind staff.
My children are starting school on the 1st, so I want to get going.
We'll give you some dark glasses, just like a Hollywood actor.
He's one of 27 million patients who've been treated at Aravind. 3.4 million of them have had surgery.
Over the next 20 years, the goal is to raise that number some tenfold. It's a measure of how ambitious the Aravind people are, but also a measure of how many people remain blind in the world whose vision can easily be restored. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazarel in Madurai, India.
It's the time of year when many of us like to get away on vacation, sometimes into the wilderness. We have a segment today on experiencing the presence of God in such places. John Leyenberger is a former atheist who had a profound religious experience on a wilderness trip. Now an ordained United Church of Christ minister, Leyenberger leads others looking for their own experience of the holy. Leyenberger is the author of Renewal in the Wilderness. He lives in Evanston, Illinois. Bob Abernethy talked with him about what happens to the people he takes to the wilderness.
What they encounter in the wilderness is getting away from all of the things in society that we call trappings that are meant to be good things, but that keep them away from a more authentic and deeper relationship with God.
Leyenberger's trips begin with his coaching.
Don't rock the canoe. These things will tip over. They're very stable, but they will tip over. I think what happens for them is they get to the transcendent through the physical, the act of canoeing, the act of setting up camp. I like to say it strips them of the barnacles that they accrue throughout their lives in society. And they begin to realize how little they need to be profoundly happy. They are able to simplify. And in that simplification, they get a sense of something holy about what surrounds them. It's a sense of well-being and a sense of being cared for and a sense of profound peace. And it's kind of a hackneyed phrase, be in the moment, but there's something so powerful about it because that is the moment in the very present is when God comes to us. It is much easier, I think, for God to get through our defenses when we're in a wilderness.
I asked Leyenberger to recall the conversion experience he had when he was alone on skis on a frozen lake in winter.
It was getting dark, and the trees were etched against the skyline in kind of a blackness while the skyline was turning purple. I just looked up at the sky and put my arms out like this with the poles dangling from my wrists and arched my back, and at that moment, I felt like I was in the midst of a warm stream of water that felt so pure and so refreshing and so cleansing and so friendly and so loving. And then it kept coming into my mind slowly at first and very dimly at first, but it said, it's God. Sometimes there are those wonderful explosive moments of experiencing God, but most of the time it's very, very subtle. It's just the small things that people ignore that being out in an environment like that brings them to an awareness of. It reminds us of who we are not, and who God is.
Back home, Leyenberger tries to recapture some of the wilderness experience in a park near his house, and he says all people can do that.
I suggest to them that they have an open heart and a willingness to be surprised, and they do it very consciously. It is part of being here now. It's part of what the wilderness teaches you.
I asked Lionberger whether some people come on his trips and have no sense of anything holy.
In the 8 years I've been doing this, and maybe the 400 people that I've taken to the wilderness, I only know of one man who was not really touched by his experience in some way, who said at the end, I had a good time, but I got no spiritual insight, no spiritual awakenings, nothing like that. And that's not a bad batting average, 1 out of 400. I'll take that.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's more of my conversation with Rashad Hussain on our website, where you can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available, and you can always follow us on our Facebook page. Join us at pbs.org.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.